From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. It's Black Friday. Let's talk about money.
She lies there in bed at night with you, looking at you, one eye open. Money never sleeps.
We'll dive into how you can improve your financial literacy.
You know, the 9 out of 10 would say we manage our finances carefully or very carefully, yet 1 out of 2 never pull a credit report.
And look at Too Big to Fail with the former chairman of Bank of America.
I dispute the issue that we still are vulnerable to failing banks.
And finally, we'll debunk the myth about why today's called Black Friday.
We can say pretty firmly that the retail explanation of Black Friday is just historically not true.
That's all coming up on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We hope you've all had a very happy Thanksgiving and are now enjoying the retail rush of Black Friday. Today is a big day for retailers and the economy, so we're going to spend the hour listening back to some of our favorite Radio Boston segments about money, about making money, spending money, and analyzing our relationship with money. We'll start with all that cash that's flowing today. Last year, shoppers spent $67 billion in stores and $2.9 billion online on Black Friday. That's according to data from the National Retail Federation. So that seems to explain why Black Friday has its name. I mean, if there's any day for a store to run in the black, it's today, right? Well, back in 2012, we spoke with Ben Zimmer, language columnist for The Wall Street Journal, and he told us that explanation for the holiday's name is absolutely, positively wrong.
It first became attached to the big post-Thanksgiving shopping rush in the early 1960s in Philadelphia, when the police who had to deal with all of the traffic headaches thought that that was just the worst day that they had to deal with. The traffic cops had to pull very long shifts, 12-hour shifts the day after Thanksgiving.
So it's a Black Friday in the 1960s because it was a dark day for police officers who had to control traffic. But from what I understand, you say that it's even the term itself, Black Friday, dates to even further back than the 1960s.
That's true. One researcher has actually turned up a mention of Black Friday referring to the Friday after Thanksgiving about a decade before that, in 1951, in a journal that was about factory management, where they talked about Black Friday having to do with worker absenteeism. So it was tough to get factory workers to show up the day after Thanksgiving, obviously, if they didn't have that off as a holiday. And so the factory managers would call that Black Friday.
Well, you've dug up a 1951 issue of Factory Management and Maintenance. It looks like an industry journal. And there's an article in it that begins like this. Again, this is 1951. Quote, Friday after Thanksgiving-itis is a disease second only to the bubonic plague in its effects. At least that's the feeling of those who have to get production out when the Black Friday comes along. The shop may be half empty, but every absentee was sick and can prove it. So again, that's from the 1951 notion of Black Friday being one of absenteeism. But as you were saying, in the 60s, it turned into this shopping term. But I understand that having it associated with a retail day actually didn't make city merchants all that happy.
No, they didn't want to be associated with this term, which was obviously very negative. And in fact, that term Black Friday has been associated with particularly notorious days all the way back to the 18th century. And there were some financial panics in the 19th century that were also referred to as Black Friday. So it had a long-standing negative connotation, certainly not one that the retailers wanted to embrace right away. So we see in the early examples of Black Friday being used to describe this big shopping day, the retailers say, can we call this something else? How about Big Friday? They wanted to rebrand it into something more positive. But Black Friday is the expression that stuck around and not Big Friday.
Yeah, I mean, given that nobody calls it Big Friday, it's safe to say that rebranding wasn't terrible failure.
What's interesting, though, is that the retailers, I think they saw they had some lemons and they made lemonade out of it. By the 1980s, they had taken that expression Black Friday and given it a new explanation. It wasn't because of all the traffic snarls that people had to deal with, but instead this story about how their stores were going to go into the black, they were going to turn a profit, starts showing up in the 1980s after about 20 years of usage.
Huh, interesting. So you've written that this misunderstanding, or maybe a better term for it is evolution, of what Black Friday really means, actually falls into the wider category of something known as etymologies. So what's an etymology?
That's a great term that a linguist at Yale University named Larry Horn came up with to describe the false etymologies that people come up with, which seem a bit like urban myths. And so there's a kind of a mythology that might spread around the stories that people tell about the origin of a word or a phrase. And so he combined etymology with mythology to create this etymology. So it's interesting to see something like this, where we can say pretty firmly that the retail explanation of Black Friday is just historically not true. But now it feeds into a kind of a mythology that the retailers themselves perpetuate over the years. And if you are in the retail business, you will learn this story. You will accept it as part of retail lore. And so it just circulates that way, even if it doesn't actually have that historical truth to it.
Ben Zimmer is the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal. We spoke with him in 2012 about the origin of the name Black Friday. All right, let's talk now about money and power. Here's Ben Affleck's take from the film The Boiler Room.
Now, y'all look money hungry, and that's good. Anybody tells you money's the root of all evil doesn't have any. They say money can't buy happiness. Look at the smile on my face. Ear to ear, baby.
Now, in the United States, there's one institution led by one person who wields significant power over the country's money and our economy, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Last year, we spoke with Boston-based journalist Roger Lowenstein about the history of the Fed. He's author of America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. And we began with the basics, such as what exactly the Federal Reserve does.
The easy answer is, if you take a dollar bill out of your wallet, it'll say Federal Reserve note in front of it, right? The money comes from the Fed, and it decides how much of that stuff is going to be circulating and how much, what would be too much. The slightly deeper answer is, just as people go to banks, banks need a bank. The Federal Reserve is the banker to banks. So when it lends more money to banks and adds to their reserves, banks have more to lend to the economy, to all of us workers and businesses and everything, and that adds to liquidity, perhaps adds to prices and inflation and so on, and stimulates the economy.
Where does the Fed get its money?
The Fed literally has a printing press. It can create reserves. It is Ben Bernanke once said there's virtually no limit. There is no limit to what we could do. Way back when, it was limited by the amount of gold that was in the vaults, but that's not true anymore. Right now, the Fed is limited only by its discretion.
I see. Okay, yeah. So it is sort of the epicenter of our fractional reserve lending system.
Well said.
It makes me sound smarter than I really am. Okay, so how did we get here? Because prior to 1913, there was no Federal Reserve Bank.
That's right. So, and America then was the only industrial nation without one. Britain had one, France had one, Russia had one, Japan had one. And we didn't have one. You sort of have to answer the question, how do we get to the point where we didn't have one before you get to how do we get to the point where we had one? We had this phobia going back to Thomas Jefferson that banks were bad, big banks were bad, big government was bad. And this is the original a conflict that he and Alexander Hamilton got in over federalism. Alexander Hamilton wanted a nation's bank. Jefferson said no. We had a couple of experiments very early in our history, and they were both abolished by Jefferson or his followers, Andrew Jackson in the second case.
And so this sort of love-hate relationship with the Fed goes back, as you're saying, to the concept of it, to the founding of the country. It's still with us today, and I do want to talk about that with you in a minute, Roger, but the actual circumstances around the creation of the Fed in 1913, as you write in your book, America's Bank, are absolutely fascinating. What was happening to the American economy in the late 19th, early 20th century that finally made people realize we need a central bank?
So there was a lot of unrest about the monetary situation, about whether there was enough money circulating. Farmers were very unhappy because we had 30 years of deflation in this country. That is to say, prices went lower and lower and lower 30 years in a row. You can imagine being a farmer, you borrow money, your crops sell for less next year. The year after that, they sell for even less. They were very unhappy. On the other hand, bankers were not so unhappy. There wasn't much, money was scarce, interest rates were high. We had a lot of conflict. But the seeming solution of a central bank was off the table. It was like a political third rail because of our history going back to Jefferson and Jackson. Americans had this sort of phobia. Yeah. I think going back to the American Revolution, this idea would be recreating the sort of thing we rebelled against in England if we created a powerful center. What finally got the ball rolling, we had a series of panics, money panics, depressions. In 1907, we had a really bad money panic that just banks just started closing down.
They literally had no money.
We literally had bank runs. People would literally run to the bank, demand money back. They'd line up. If you were there early, you might have gotten your deposits out. If you weren't, tough luck. It started in New York. It spread from weak banks to healthy banks in New York. Then it spread to other cities across the country. And there was no Ben Bernanke. There was no Janet Yellen. There was no lender of last resort to come in and say, enough, I'm going to start lending because nobody else is lending. At that point, people realized, although they weren't sure what the solution was, that the existing system didn't work.
Right, and it's interesting because the American economy itself was undergoing this major transition from an agricultural economy to a more industrial one. There we were seeing, you know, as we enter the teens and, of course, the 20s, the rapid consolidation of wealth and the Gilded Age. I mean, like, when you think about it.
Very much an issue. Inequality.
Yeah, it sounds so familiar, doesn't it?
People were angry at banks. They were angry at bankers. All very familiar.
And there's a meeting off the coast of Georgia on a secret island.
Okay, Megan, this is the part where the story
gets... wearing a tinfoil hat here.
No. Like, now really. Is the place where the story gets hijacked by Hollywood scriptwriters. But except it wasn't. It's true. There's so much opprobrium directed at bankers after this panic. And yet Aldrich, who now wants to write a bill for a central bank, but realizes that if the public knows he's doing that, if Wall Street's involved, he'll be ridden out of town on a rail. So he decides to do it in secret. He invites three of the top bankers in the country to go down on his private rail car. They go from New York all the way to Georgia. They're dressed ridiculously as if they're going on a hunting party. One of them is carrying a shotgun with cartridges. They wouldn't even know which way to point it. And they go off to a private club where J.P. Morgan has cleared everybody else out. And for a week, nobody, not their family, not their secretaries, not the people in their companies know, and they write what becomes the first draft of the eventual Federal Reserve Act in utter secrecy.
Wow. You know, and in your book, you also write about President Woodrow Wilson as being quite a statesman in order, because opprobrium is the word you used earlier, and I think that's absolutely true. And yet, you know, there were so many opposing forces around this idea of the Fed, and yet come 1913, we actually get a Federal Reserve created.
Wilson is a very strong figure. I'm glad you brought him up because I think Americans tend to remember the older Wilson.
The failed League of Nations.
Exactly. The failed foreign policy guy. This Wilson had just been elected in 1912. He had electrified the country, relatively young, full of ideals, former college president. And he's able to both make the tough decisions and the tough compromises. At one point, he's still president-elect, Carter Glass, a Southern congressman, brings him a plan for a new reserve system. And Wilson looks at it. And because Carter Glass is a Southern Democrat opposed to any sort of federal intervention, the plan just consists of 20 different reserve centers around the country, no link between them, no federal role at all. And Wilson, who's after all a student of history himself, says, this is fine, but we need to centralize this thing. We need to have what he called a capstone. That capstone drew into the Federal Reserve. Mm. He goes on to make several other key decisions that shape the bill, and then he really has muscle in getting it through Congress.
Right.
There's a Lyndon Johnson side to Woodrow Wilson, at least in his younger years. He's quite forceful, and he's quite effective.
So this is a story of how, people who are politically opposed to one another, very, very strong. I mean, even William Jennings Bryan eventually becomes a supporter of the Fed. They come together and manage to create this new institution. Do you think anything like that could happen today?
You know, I kept thinking that as I wrote the book. I just want to refer to one compromise in particular, because they've got a draft of the Fed, and the people in the Federal Reserve Board in this draft are all going to be bankers, chosen by bankers. And William Jennings Bryan, of course, great populist, great or terrible, depending on your politics, but he's a populist. He's in Wilson's cabinet because he really helped make Wilson president. He says this won't fly. If we're going to have this new institution supervising the banking system, the people in the Federal Reserve Board have to be public. They have to be political appointees. And Wilson makes that switch. Bankers, of course, are horrified that they are now going to be reporting. Their industry is going to be supervised by public appointees. But kicking and screaming, they go along with it. That was the type of compromise that Wilson forced down their throats. He also pushed back at the other side, pushed back at the farmers and so on. At the end of the day, despite truly deep conflicts between bankers and farmers, Republicans and Democrats, people here in the Northeast and people out west and down south, they got through a workable and salutary and enduring solution. You ask, can we still do this today? And, you know, I hope they look at this era as a model, because I think we've lost a lot of that ability.
I mean, and the Fed is a primary target for modern-day opprobrium.
Their bills, you know, the Fed has a terrible reputation. And by the way, I've said that if they had failed to rescue the system, I could understand it. But they're really hated and vilified because they stepped in and saved the system. And there are bills up and down Congress today to strip it of what power it has now.
Roger Lowenstein is a Boston-based financial journalist, former Wall Street Journal reporter, and author of the book America's Bank: The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. We spoke with him last year. Stay with us, because after the break in this special Money Hour of Radio Boston, you'll get a primer on managing your money. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On this Black Friday, we're listening back to some of our favorite conversations about money. And if you've been out buying today, or if you've been avoiding shoppers like the plague, how do you think about how much it is you spend? And what influences your attitudes about money? Well, there's a good chance that no one ever really formally taught you how to deal with your finances, whether it be via television or word of mouth or maybe a little parental guidance or even the internet. On average, financial education in America is patchy at best. So back in 2012, we held a roundtable on financial literacy and the lack thereof. It included Margaret Miley, strategic advisor of the Midas Collaborative, Thais DeMarco, director of economic opportunity at the Somerville Community Corporation, and then undersecretary of the Office of Consumer Affairs and Business Regulation, Barbara Anthony. Anthony's office had just surveyed 400 Massachusetts consumers to find out how much people actually know about their finances. And as Barbara Anthony told us, there are significant gaps.
First of all, let me say that we in Massachusetts think we know a lot about everything. I think that's probably true.
Sometimes we're right
sometimes,
about
but
that.
Sometimes we do. Sometimes we don't. But you know, I think that the general level of financial awareness was pretty good, but the gaps were significant, and I think that significance is important. So one of the things that surprised me was this: 9 out of 10 people said that they manage carefully or very carefully their personal finances. Oh, so you think that's pretty good, you know, 9 out of 10. Then we asked them how many people pull their credit report once a year. That came down to 1 out of 2. So you get 9 out of 10 saying we manage our personal finances very carefully, but yet only 1 out of 2 consumers pull the report.
And so, 34% say they never do.
And 34%, that's a third at least, saying that they never do. That's very disconcerting. But, so I had this conversation with some friends, very well-educated, savvy people, and they said, well, I never pull my credit report. What does that have to do with the way I manage my personal finances? Good question. It has the following. First of all, how do you know there aren't any mistakes on your credit report that may affect your credit score or your ability to borrow money from a lender, number one, or do other things? Number two, how do you know someone hasn't stolen your identity and is taking out credit in your name? the bill's not going to come to you because that's not how the thieves work. The bill's being sent somewhere else. So you don't know if there's a mistake that could hurt you. You don't know whether somebody has committed identity theft. You can't really have control over your personal finances unless you know those things.
Okay, so there's a gap there between what we think we know and what we should know.
That's right.
So you've also done some, you also asked people some questions about, say, financial products that are available to them, banking products, in terms of, and that was trying to get at how much do we know about what's out there in terms of, you know, how we can do basic banking. And what'd you find?
Exactly. Well, you know, we've got in Massachusetts, we've got some great banking laws here with respect to financial services products for low-income people, for young people, and for seniors. The 1865 law. If you're 65 or older, 18 or younger, you get one free checking and one free savings account at a Massachusetts state chartered bank. We found that I think it was only 52% of the people we surveyed knew that. So that means 48%, although, you know, let's just say 50-50. So one out of two people in the state don't know that if they're 18 or younger or 65 or older, they can get a free, I mean free checking and savings account from their community banks.
Does that make you think that a lot of people are using financial products that they're essentially overpaying for?
Oh, well, absolutely. If you could get a free checking account, and you're paying for a checking account, and it's not giving you things that you really, that they're giving you things maybe that you don't need, then you are overpaying for that product. The thing that tells me that people are doing is that they don't know that this product is available for free. They also, you know, I'm assuming that the same would be true. We have something called basic banking products here in Massachusetts for low-income people. 91 banks have signed on to this service voluntarily. You get, for $36 a year, you get 8 checks a month and 15 withdrawals a month. A very good deal, particularly for low-income people. Now, we didn't ask that specific question here, but my bet is that if you get that kind of a response on the 1865 question, that people are similarly not informed about these basic banking services.
So I want to peel back sort of the different layers of the financial world that this survey reveals to us. But I also want to ask you a couple of your big picture takeaways. I mean, it seemed as if there was some correlation across the answers between, say, how much people, again, these are self-reported, right? So how much people say they knew or how proactive they were, and income level.
That's correct. I think we found that generally higher income levels, higher educational levels, and also older folks in the survey seem to have a greater depth of knowledge in terms of their financial products and services. You know, I say sometimes with age goes wisdom. Maybe I say that because I won't mention that why. But at any rate, I think that's probably true. As you get older, you learn more. Obviously, you've had more experience. But the income piece, I think, is troubling. And the fact that maybe, you know, younger people across the board were not as well informed as they are should be.
So, but on the other hand, okay, it may make sense that with age and income, you get a higher correlation of people who say they think they know more about money and how and their financial picture. But the world of finance and finances is so complicated these days. I mean, is that basically a facile conclusion here? Like that is the truth that, quite frankly, we're not sure that anyone knows enough?
Well, all we know is how the data correlated. So, and I know you weren't accusing us of being facile, but that's how the data correlated. And I think that, you know, you may have more experience with more sophisticated financial products the higher your income. I mean, there may be reasons for that. But I think that generally, like I said, you know, the 9 out of 10 who say we manage our finances carefully or very carefully, yet 1 out of 2 never pull a credit report. And that was across all income groups. So I think that no matter your income group, no matter your educational level, there are gaps here that are troubling. You know, we see foreclosures, not to switch the subject completely, but we see foreclosures in the market across all income groups, you know, and those products are complex. And we see them among all educational groups. I mean, you go to foreclosure events and you meet nurses and city councilors and accountants and people from all income strata. So I think, you know, you're correct, Magda. It's not relegated to any particular income group.
Margaret Miley, I mean, as a member of the MIDAS Collaborative, this is sort of what you're thinking about, is how to get people more financially stable and literate. Do you think that, as Barbara Anthony was talking about, increased awareness is a part of it? I mean, it seems to me that by the time people are earning money or might be dealing with the questions of their 401k, it's a whole other world we're going to get into in a moment, it's almost I don't want to say it's too late, but can't we start earlier in terms of financial literacy?
Absolutely. It seems to be a multifaceted need, and so we should have a multifaceted approach. And as Secretary Anthony is saying, there are a lot of us trying to coordinate around providing credible, non-vendor-specific information on finances for people at all parts of their lifespan.
So non-vendor-specific meaning it's not a product that someone's trying to sell you.
Exactly. So we want to have neutral information around out and available that is very consumer protective, and we're very realistic in terms of understanding that people reach out for information at the particular time that they need it. So there's not a mother of a two-year-old who's doing as much looking at college options as the mother of the 15-year-old, for example. And people aren't thinking about their 401ks when they're 12 years old either. So we're really trying to correlate the information and the services with the lifespan of the people as they're moving through their lives.
Thais DeMarco, let me ask you, you're actually working with people directly at Somerville Community Cooperation. When they come to you, what are the kind of questions that they ask? Are you surprised or not surprised by how much they may not know when they first come in to your organization?
I've been doing this for almost 6 years now, so I'm not surprised anymore. I think one of the key things about financial education is that, and this sounds silly when I say it, but it's so true, people don't know what they don't know. And so when you ask people, are you doing everything you can for your finances, often they will say, yes, of course I am, because they don't really know what the steps are that they need to be taking. So people come to us with all kinds of questions. They come to us with issues with credit. They come to us when they're trying to buy a home and they need to deal with credit. There are several different things that they come to ask.
And so how do you, I mean, what are the first steps that you take to sort of walk people through things and get them to a place of greater financial literacy?
We have a comprehensive intake that we do with everybody to try to assess their situation overall and what kinds of needs they have. And then based on that intake, we direct them to one of our classes, maybe our one-on-one counseling. We do offer financial literacy classes that are actually really comprehensive. It's 6 weeks, 18 hours total. So we spend a lot of time with folks talking about it.
And, you know, Margaret Miley was saying that you don't often, say, get a mother of a two-year-old who's coming in, maybe unless she's thinking about applying for a mortgage. You know, it just seems that people's interest and desire to know about their personal financial well-being sort of peaks around these big moments in life. Is that what you're seeing, that it's need that really drives us rather than an overall sense as to, hey, maybe I need to, for the rest of my life, be on top of my financial picture?
Financial education isn't it doesn't seem like the most exciting thing you could do on, say, a Monday night, although I would disagree. Our classes are very exciting. So I think that's why we see people coming to us in crisis mostly, although we've done a lot of work at the Somerville Community Corporation to make sure that people hear about the service before they get to a point of crisis so that they know that it's there.
To my mind, it seems that there couldn't be anything more relevant in terms of what people need to know than how to manage their finances. There are some efforts on this front, Margaret Miley, are there not?
Absolutely. A group of nonprofits, governmental agencies, and financial institutions and other corporations got together to form what was called the Massachusetts Financial Education Collaborative in the last couple of years. A lot of folks are involved in it. One thing we've really been pushing is this idea of universal access to financial education in the K-12 system.
Barbara Anthony, we just got about a minute to go, but I do have to ask you, you are part of the Office of Consumer Affairs and Business Regulation. We've been talking about individual responsibility and trying to teach people how to manage their own finances better. But I do wonder, the products themselves are getting so much more complicated every single year. Is there not room for, in this financial literacy conversation, to get businesses to quite frankly simplify what they're offering people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a two-way street. Businesses have to do their job in terms of more compact, fairer, clearer disclosures. I have to say one last thing, though.
Just got a couple seconds, but
it's not free annualcreditreport.com. Don't go to those folks. They will charge you money. Go to annualcreditreport.com, annualcreditreport.com.
Amen.
For a free credit report. Forget that jingle.
Actually, I'm glad I'm glad you did that, because that was going to be my last thought. But annualcreditreport.com.
It is the only federal government authorized free credit report Report website. Forget all the others.
That was Barbara Anthony, then the Undersecretary of the Office of Consumer Affairs and Business Regulation. You also heard from Margaret Miley, Strategic Advisor at the Midas Collaborative, and Thais DeMarco, Director of Economic Opportunity at the Somerville Community Corporation. We spoke with them back in 2012 after the Undersecretary had released a survey on how much Massachusetts residents know about their finances. By the way, the Office of Consumer Affairs and Business Regulation has since changed administrations, of course, and it doesn't do these surveys anymore. We reached out to them, and they said they're focusing on other issues. Coming up, the biggest money of them all, the former chairman of Bank of America on Too Big to Fail. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In honor of this Black Friday, we've been listening back to some of our favorite conversations about money. We've talked about spending money, saving money, and now let's talk about big money.
$1 million isn't cool. You know what's cool?
$1 billion.
That's a clip from the film The Social Network. But in that vein, let me give you a couple of other numbers. $250 billion, $430 billion, $2 trillion. Those are the total assets held right now by TD Bank, U.S. Bank, and the Bank of America, respectively. The nation's largest banks today are, in fact, bigger than they were before the 2008 financial crisis. So, are they too big to fail? Well, that's the question we posed to Chad Gifford. He's former chairman of the Bank of America, and we spoke with him last May after his retirement. Gifford had a legendary 50-year career in the New England banking industry. And in our conversation, he said he doesn't actually think the banking industry has done a good job explaining why big banks are important.
The problems in 08, as far as I'm concerned, had many godfathers and godmothers, not just the big banks. Big banks made mistakes. But whether it's government policies, rating agencies, regulators, borrowers themselves, not shrinking back from some of the securities that were put together that went bad, which the banks were guilty of. Most of the origination of those mortgages were mortgage bankers rather than banks. But beyond that, right now the global financial system is incredibly complicated. And trillions of transactions, maybe not trillions, but billions of transactions a day. And if anybody, in my opinion, who's rational, can take the big banks out of that with their levels of capital, their expertise, I think they're crazy. So I think that's important. We'll have another downturn. And when another downturn happens, who is going to help the government out of the jungle?
People would say it would be the taxpayers.
We'll get to that. What's happened? Bear Stearns got into trouble. J.P. Morgan took them over. Merrill Lynch was tottering. Bank of America took them over. The government needs those kind of allies when we have difficulty.
So let's talk a little bit more about that because, you know, right now there is a lot of talk about the role that the banks play in the U.S. economy. And I'm wondering if we could just take it down to the level of current voters. Say that you were talking to, you know, a young person who's 30. They graduated from college and entered the economy right after 08. And they've had a tough time sort of getting a foothold in terms of growing their own their own wealth and their life. Or say you were talking about a worker on the edge of retirement who's seen their earning power progressively drop over the past 30 years and a lot of job uncertainty, a lot of retirement uncertainty, et cetera. How would you tell them that their lives have felt an impact or a positive impact from the big banks?
Well, number one, since 08, the deposits of the big banks, and let's say the big banks being Wells, Citibank, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, deposits have grown. People aren't running away from us. If somebody says break up the big banks, who are they going to tell, okay, I'm sorry, Megan, you can't do business with one of these banks again anymore. They're going to be broken up. What are you going to say to the corporations, small and large, that provide the services? Our business is growing because we have products to grow it. So we live in a populous world where anything big, not just banks, here in Massachusetts, I'm on the board of partners in Mass General, which I think of it, Mass General, one of the incredible institutions in this region or this country. We're criticized for our size. Everybody gets on big things. We watch the heat that Google starts taking, given their remarkable control of information. But what we've learned, I think, from Trump and from Sanders in particular, is there is tremendous anger out there. The middle class is not growing as it should. So wages have been stagnant. And I think some of the rhetoric of vitriol doesn't help, but rather, what can we do about it?
Yeah. You know, I'm really grateful and eager to hear your detailed perspective on this because of your long history in the financial industry. I mean, as you know, just last month, in April, the Federal Reserve and the FDIC put out a letter, a report, saying that 5 out of 8 of the nation's largest banks don't yet have what they called credible plans for winding down in the event of another crisis. Bank of America was one of those banks. And Thomas Hoenig, the vice chairman of the FDIC, said in a statement that the goal to end too big to fail and protect the American taxpayer by ending bailouts remains just that, only a goal.
There are a number of regulators that don't think we should have big banks. The Fed also said, and I believe the FDIC as well, that the banks have made remarkable improvement in getting here. In my opinion, the bank that I retired as a director from last week is the strongest financial institution I've ever been part of. And that goes back to the 50 bloody years I've been in the bank, measured by capital ratios, measured by the quality of the credit portfolio. So I dispute the issue that we still are vulnerable to failing banks.
So two things there. One is, it seems that the federal government itself disagrees with you because they said that the current arrangements could pose serious and adverse effects to the financial stability of the United States. And you seem to be saying completely the opposite.
I don't agree with that comment. As I tried to say earlier, I believe the big banks are absolutely critical when times get tough because of their strength, because of their management expertise. Yes, they're very large. You have banks like ours with a diversity of cash flow, not dependent on certain geographies. We saw the problems in New England back 20 years ago. When you're dependent on one local geography, you're vulnerable. One local product, you're vulnerable. The big banks are much more diversified than that. So, yes, I disagree with those comments. You say the federal government. The federal government's pretty large.
Well, in this case, it's the Fed and the FDIC.
Yeah, but if you read the entire report, I think you'd see great progress. I know you say it because it's written that way.
So I guess maybe I already know your answer to this, but I have sort of this fundamental philosophical question. And let's just accept for a moment that there are a lot of people, some of whom are very influential, who do believe that the big banks are too big to fail, and they have a problem with that. Let's just accept that for a moment. And I'm wondering what you think about this, that if our economy, both in the United States and globally, is so fundamentally reliant on these enormous institutions to function as they need to in the 21st century. And it's those same institutions that people are worried could bring down the economy, as we saw we were at the cusp of in 2008. Isn't there a fundamental structural problem with that relationship?
To me, the risk in the next time we have a tough 08 type of thing won't be the big banks. It'll be the people like the hedge funds. It'll be the unregulated, the so-called shadow banks, which have very large positions, which have very large investments without the capital strength, without the management expertise that I think the big banks have. You know, one of the other things that irritates me is when people say banks don't want regulations. That's crazy. Banks must have regulations. I think, frankly, many of the regulations are one of the reasons we are the strongest in the world.
You know, it's easy to think that this concern about the role that these enormous financial institutions play in the economy, that it's sort of the Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warrens of the world who are most vocal about those concerns. But, you know, I was remembering that Neil Kashkari, who's currently the head of the Federal Reserve in Minneapolis, and he served in the Treasury Department under Hank Paulson in the administration of George W. Bush, he, back in February, gave a speech where he himself proposed that breaking up the big banks should be something that the United States does consider doing. I mean, he said And this is a quote from his February 2016 speech. He said, "When the technology bubble burst in 2000, it was very painful for Silicon Valley and for tech investors, but it did not represent a systemic risk to our economy. Large banks must similarly be able to make mistakes, even very big mistakes, without requiring taxpayer bailouts and without triggering widespread economic damage. That must be our goal." That's what he said. And then he went on to recommend breaking up the large banks into smaller, less connected entities. He even added turning large banks into public utilities by forcing them to hold so much capital that they virtually can't fail. And then, in addition, he said maybe we ought to consider taxing leverage throughout the whole financial system to reduce systemic risk. I mean, that is virtually unimaginable with the current situation we have. But I bring this up because it's not just Elizabeth Warren. It's not just Bernie Sanders. Here's someone who served as a Republican in the Treasury who also has these concerns.
You've picked two people, Honig and the chap in Minneapolis, who absolutely have said what you just said. They have made it very clear that they think the big banks should be broken up. That's two regulators out of hundreds, hardly a majority. So, in my opinion, there are many others in the same fraternity, very experienced, understand the importance that the big banks play. By the way, one thing, Senator Sanders, and again, I think he and Trump has hit upon great unease in our country in terms of income disparity, true job growth, Main Street, Wall Street, and we all have to acknowledge that. I want them to sit down and say, okay, be part of a discussion. You break up the big banks. That sounds terrific. What is the collateral damage?
You mentioned the word unease in terms of people's unease with the concept of these big banks and the roles that they play. 2008 is why there's so much unease.
Absolutely. Even today.
I mean, and it was Bank of America itself that made, back in 2014, an almost $17 billion settlement with the government, the largest ever for a single American entity for, as the DOJ categorizes it, financial fraud leading up to and during the financial crisis. So, there's a lot of people who say, look, I heard you say earlier, Chad Gifford, that there were a lot of players in the run-up to 2008, hedge funds, mortgage generators, the countrywides of America. But many, many people say that it wouldn't have cascaded through the economy the way it did had it not been for the big banks who were then, in part putting money out for these loans and coming back and securitizing them and then selling them off. And that the very thing that you say they're good at, which is handling the complexity, is what allowed the crisis to, threaten the U.S. economy. I guess what I'm getting at is, given our recent history, what's the way forward to get past that unease?
You're 100% right. The unease, the litigation settlements, mm-hmm. $17 billion, and there were others as well, has clearly given us a black mark. And if I weren't involved, as I think I am, and have the experience that I think I do, reading about all those settlements, I would be angry as hell. I'm not a lawyer. I think a lot of the settlements blew us away. I'd like to think those are done. As it relates to the specific crisis in 08, it was obviously residential real estate, home prices down 35%. Residential homes for almost everybody, individuals and institutions, residential mortgages, a diversified group of residential mortgages, were for 40 years the AAA1 credit. The fact is there were some many subprime mortgages made that should have been made. Most of those were not, as it relates to Bank of America, most of that was Countrywide, as you probably know, which we bought in 07 or 08, whatever. We didn't make the mortgages. We bought it, so yeah, it's on our candle.
Well, you didn't make them, but then you securitized them and sold the securities.
We did, but remember, it was the AAA1. Remember, until 09, Moody's and Standard & Poor's had these things rated AAA1. The thought that the mentality of the companies, the big banks, were knowingly securitizing lousy loans you know, I think is preposterous.
Well, but Goldman's, I mean, isn't that exactly what happened with Goldman Sachs, though?
Well, I think that what happened to Goldman Sachs is probably the same that's happened to everybody. I don't know if that's unique.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is, what was it, in 2010 or so, at a federal hearing, there were some emails that were presented to Lloyd Blankfein when he was testifying that basically said that seemed to show that Goldman was knowingly selling securities, mortgage-backed securities, that they knew weren't as highly rated as they should be, that they were essentially toxic, and then also shorting those same securities.
I think that's terrible. I don't think that was not widespread when you're talking, particularly that latter statement, shorting those same securities. I think as the market heated up, there was what I still consider some bad actors, and I think we could have been more careful on that. But again, I think that's basically indicting a community when you have one or two bad apples.
Mm. You know, I'm not in the business of pinning all the blame on individual bad actors, because this is a complex system that we have, right? So from your perspective, post-Dodd-Frank, because I heard you say a little earlier that bankers actually love regulation or need regulation. I'm just wondering.
We respect regulation.
Okay, you respect regulation. So what are there specific things in addition to Dodd-Frank that you think could help further stabilize the system or prevent, you know, future 2008s?
I think we have enough regulation right now. I don't think I'm not proposing more regulation.
Okay. Well, let's. I'm going to totally shift gears here, because you've been quite a gentleman regarding the too big to fail question. It's possibly one of the most important points of discussion, I think, politically and economically.
Even as we sit here, I'm not sure I've done a good enough job explaining why I believe we would be much worse off without the strong, large banks. I think they play an incredibly pivotal job in this society. Small business, residential, large companies, institutional. And I think we would be worse off without J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo and Citigroup and the Bank of America.
What if there was a new form of Glass-Steagall? I mean, could you have the same capacity, the same expertise, the same wherewithal, but with just that additional protection put in?
I think on balance, we'd be worse off with another aspect of Glass-Steagall. I think what Glass-Steagall did for our customers, and we really try to think of our customers. When you do the job for customers, you're going to do the job for shareholders. Particularly those with sophisticated financing requirements, not just global, but wanting to hedge certain parts of the business. It's Glass-Steagall which allows us to do that, to raise equity for companies. And I think America and free enterprise, and for me, it's free enterprise. It's taking risk to make a profit. It's taking risk, and you make a profit, you grow, and you employ. I believe the banks strongly help that, enable that.
Last question. So you started off in the world of banking as a loan officer, right?
Right.
Right there at the retail level. I'm just wondering.
The commercial level.
Commercial banking as a loan officer. I'm just curious if there were any lessons in those early years that stayed with you as you went from that, you know, all the way to leading some of the world's largest financial institutions.
Sure. Credit is still the principal component of our balance sheet, which means loans. As a young officer, I made a lousy loan, and I learned then what can go wrong. And when you make a loan, you start with the character of the person. You have to have a little cynic in you about what could be on the downside, and it helped prepare me. One thing that when I was made elected president of the bank, 89, however long that is, Dick Hill, who was my predecessor by two, an incredible man, said, "Remember, Chad, your most important job is to make sure you open the doors the next morning." That's always stayed with me.
Well, Chad Gifford, thank you so much for your time and for talking with me. I'm really grateful for it.
No, it was fun. Thank you. My pleasure. I'm not sure I convinced you about big banks, but I believe I'm right.
Chad Gifford is a 50-year veteran of the New England financial industry and a longtime civic leader and philanthropist in Boston. We spoke with him last May after his retirement from the board of directors of Bank of America. Now, who's hot, who not? Tell me who rock, who sell out in the stores? You tell me who... Well, that's it for today's special Black Friday edition of Radio Boston. And before we go, let me leave you with this one final thought from the brilliant satirist Jonathan Swift. It's a couple of centuries old, but as relevant today as it was when Swift first said it. A wise person should have money in their head, but not in their heart. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Have a great weekend. This is Radio Boston. B-I-G-P-O-P-P-A. No info for the DEA. Federal agents mad cause I'm flagrant. Tap myself and the phone in the basement. My team supreme, stay clean. Triple beam, miracle dream. I'll be that. Catch a seat at all events bent. It's in holsters, girls on shoulders.